Why is our Constitution made for a moral and religious people and is wholly inadequate to the government of any other? Because a people lacking in virtue could be counted on to trade away their liberty for protection.
Dr. Robert George of Princeton University speaking on the Constitution and civic virtue at the 2021 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
For financial prosperity or economic security, for comfort, for being looked after, by being given stuff by the government, for being taken care of, for having their problems solved quickly. Adams and really smart people like Adams realize that there are always going to be people, politicians, demagogues, who are out there saying, all you've got to do is give up your liberty and we're going to make you really happy.
You can watch an on-demand video stream of this year's Making the Case conference for a tax-deductible gift of $300. Learn more at issuesetc.org. How could the Founding Fathers say, in particular Thomas Jefferson, that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal? In principle, a truth that, well, while not always lived out in our nation's history, in principle, one that we have taken for granted, that we are created equal. That implies a creator, and that equality is rooted in something other than what we do, the color of our skin, our level of development, our level of cognition. We are simply created equal. What's happened to that particular way of viewing human equality in medical ethics, and what has replaced it? Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're going to talk about secularized medicine and human equality. Dr. Charles Camosi is our guest. He's Associate Professor of Theological and Social Ethics at Fordham University. He's authored the new book, Losing Our Dignity, How Secularized Medicine is Undermining Fundamental Human Equality. Dr. Camosi, welcome back.
Hi, Todd. Great to chat.
What is the traditional foundation for intrinsic human equality and dignity?
Well, I guess I'm a little biased speaking as a Christian theologian, but at least for the West, for the last 2,000 years, it's been this concept of being made in the image and likeness of God, and maybe even more precisely, having a common nature, which bears the image and likeness of God. So it has nothing to do with what traits you have or in what capacity you have certain traits, but rather the nature that you have, what essentially is in the very most part of your being, whether that's fully expressed or not, whether you're old or young, abled or disabled, doesn't matter. But that's been, for 2,000 years at least, the sense that we all are equal in this capacity. Yeah.
Why did previous generations consider this concept of human equality, not only its foundation, but its conclusion, self-evident?
Well, you know, it doesn't take a student of history to know that we haven't always lived it out, but we at least did think in our founding documents in the U.S. especially that this was self-evident, and it's right there in our founding documents saying it's self-evident. And I think the reason for that is because it was self-evident to those folks that there was a God who created us this way. It would have been almost impossible, not totally impossible, but almost impossible for someone raised in that era to think otherwise. They didn't live it out equally. They didn't live it out consistently, obviously, but at least they had that self-evidence to appeal to when, you know, those who wanted to push for more equality to say, you know, we all believe this. Do we actually believe it? Because we're not really living it out. And what I think is different today, obviously, is it's for some, it's self-evident that this is not true, that there even is a God at all, but that God created us all equal. And so, yeah, we're certainly that's part of what my book is trying to explore, is this fairly uncharted territory over the last half century anyway of rejecting this idea.
With that rejection, what has replaced this view of the human being in medical ethics and the practice of medicine?
Well, it's, you know, almost a species of what's happened in the culture more broadly. So again, as I just mentioned, we've at least many parts of this country in the early part of the 21st century find it difficult to even talk about God or a nature that reflects the image and likeness of God. And they've tried to fill it with various other things, moral capacities, the very thing that, you know, a more ancient tradition rejects. So, you know, what makes us all equal is that we all have autonomy or rationality, self-awareness, even productivity, especially in a capitalist culture, right? The idea of that we produce. Are you a productive member of society is probably something your listeners have heard many times. But what's so clear about that, at least to me and I think to many others, is that precisely because it rejects the older version, the more ancient version, many, many human beings don't have those capacities in equal measure. And some, frankly, don't appear to have them at all. But I don't think what's happened in medicine and medical ethics in particular, which lives, you know, at the boundaries of life and death, is that whole populations of human beings over the last 50 years, especially since this rejection has come into full force, as it's come into full force gradually over time, more and more of these populations have ceased to be equal, both in our kind of ethos and culture, but also in law. And I make an argument in the book that medicine's undue influence on these questions has had played a major role in that.
Is this rejection a move away from essence to accidents, kind of in that Aristotelian sense, or is it a rejection of essence itself?
I think it depends who you talk to. That's an excellent question. I think it depends who you talk to. I think we struggle with, you know, essence is kind of a metaphysical term. We struggle with metaphysics today as a culture, as a postmodern culture. Like, what is an essence even at all? But even if one accepts an essence as a thing, I think you're right to suggest that we've put more focus on accidents and on how accidentally rational you are or how accidentally productive you are based on a whole series of accidents, right? So the accidents of what kind of genes you're given, what kind of disease you may inherit or contract, what kind of injuries you may sustain, how old or how young you are. We knew for most of the last 2,000 years that, at least in principle, none of that should matter for your dignity and your fundamental equality with the rest of the human family. Again, didn't live it all perfectly, but that was the underlying assumption. Now, those things, which again, in a Thomistic Aristotelian sense, are accidents, are the only thing that our culture really can make sense of in terms of what and how to assign moral value.
How does this new ethic insist on or even require a sliding scale of equality?
Well, yeah, so it's, again, an excellent question. You might say that a prenatal child or someone with dementia at the end of their life has no self-awareness anymore, right? They've just lost it completely. And in that sense, doesn't have any equality with anyone, right? They're just a non-person. Part of my argument in the book is we've said that about prenatal children. We haven't quite said it about our elderly who've lost their self-awareness at the end of their life, but there's really no principled reason why we shouldn't, or why if we push consistently to, you know, this view, why it wouldn't end up that way. But then, as your question rightly implies, you don't have to go to that dramatic of a level. You could just say, well, some are more self-aware than others, or some are more rational than others, or some are more productive than others. And this gets into, I think, a lot of the discourse today about disability rights and disability studies and our culture's, I think, at least in some areas, rightful turn to focusing on disability because people with disability are so marginalized in this point of view. But what I find so fascinating about these discussions is, though we intuit that this is a problem, we have sort of undercut or undermined our basis for saying why it's a problem. Like, why is it a problem that those who are more productive or more rational or more self-aware, more autonomous than others matter more in certain circumstances than those who are less? The reason is, I think, because they share a common nature, and that's what makes them equal, not their accidental, you know, reflection of these particular qualities. But once you get rid of that concept of a nature, once you get especially rid of the concept of a nature that reflects the image and likeness of God as a reason for mattering, again, I just think you kind of undercut or undermine your very basis for criticizing a kind of ableist culture that discriminates on the basis of abilities.
Many have expressed caution about the human slash person distinction. I think you share some of that caution, but if you would describe the debate over human and personal equality.
Right. So on the one hand, I do think there's a helpful distinction to make between human and person in the following sense, that not all persons are human, right? So you could say, especially as a Christian who believes in angels and demons, for instance, that angels and demons are non-human persons. To use, going back to the ancient language, they're substances of a rational and relational nature. Nature is the key, very key part of that definition. But what I take to be deeply problematic as a distinction between human and person is saying that certain humans are non-persons, right? The human non-persons, the concept of a human non-person. And that's precisely what I was mentioning earlier with regard to prenatal children. There's no biologist in the world who will say that, you know, a 16-week prenatal child with a beating heart, capable of remembering the voice of his mother and father, or her mother and father, and just innumerable qualities of a member of the species Homo sapiens, is not a member of the species Homo sapiens. That would just be a scientifically and biologically illiterate view. But what's instead proposed is that this is a human being, but not a person, right? So you don't have the actualized, again, it's not a nature that's important, but you don't have the actualized traits of rationality, self-awareness, autonomy, and productivity. And therefore, there end up being many, in fact. I think we're just now starting, and that's part of why I wrote my book, is to sound the alarm. We're just now starting, I think, to really apply this more consistently in our culture. So, you know, with regard to prenatal children, you talk about the classic example of a human non-person, but I think you'd also talk about it at the end of life with regard to dementia, and there's several other examples in the book. But yeah, that the first distinction I think is fine and good and theologically very, very common. The second is deeply, deeply problematic, especially from the standpoint of anyone who believes in Matthew 25 and looking for the least among us.
Dr. Charles Camosi is our guest. He's author of the new book, Losing Our Dignity, How Secularized Medicine is Undermining Fundamental Human Equality. We're discussing secularized medicine, human dignity, and equality. Many have observed that Western healthcare owes its existence to religious ideas. We'll find out how after this.
Why is our Constitution made for a moral and religious people and is wholly inadequate to the government of any other? Because a people lacking in virtue could be counted on to trade away their liberty for protection.
Dr. Robert George of Princeton University speaking on the Constitution and civic virtue at the 2021 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
For financial prosperity or economic security, for comfort, for being looked after, by being given stuff by the government, for being taken care of, for having their problems solved quickly. Adams and really smart people like Adams realize that there are always going to be people, politicians, demagogues, who are out there saying, all you've got to do is give up your liberty and we're going to make you really happy.
You can watch an on-demand video stream of this year's Making the Case conference for a tax-deductible gift of $300. Learn more at issuesetc.org.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Remember when education was about the fundamental skills of reading, writing, and arithmetic? And about reading great literature and studying history to give our kids a model for what it is to be a good person? Memoria Press's classical Christian curriculum offers that very model for your homeschool. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR21. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
I am beautiful because I am fearfully and wonderfully made.
I am accepted because I'm a part of His family through Jesus' shed blood. Unity Lutheran School in East St. Louis, Illinois, shines the light of Christ in one of the most impoverished cities in America. Learn how to support their mission work at unityesl.org. Unityesl.org.
Today, with the help of the Holy Spirit, I say yes to God in His ways.
Real America is the Civil War and the 13th Amendment. Real America is not segregation. It's Martin Luther King. It's the Civil Rights Process. It's the Voting Rights Act. It's the 24th Amendment. And I think older Americans take pride at the fact that we have made so much, almost indescribable progress.
Critical race theory is not saying that America is racist because there were racist laws. It's saying that there were racist laws because America's racist.
We see ourselves in Christ, and therefore we cannot be claimed by identity politics or any other competing ideology that's vying for our allegiance. And this is why allegiance to Christ is the supreme identity maker for us.
And so I said, I was just in Africa, and the culture over there is that marriage is a man and a woman still. It's this idea of two men being married. That's not African culture at all. I said, why is it that the Holy Spirit speaks through white, liberal culture, and not through the culture in Africa?
Friday afternoon, August the 6th, we'll play Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. You do not have to listen live to participate. You'll find this week's candidates on the Talk On Demand archives page at issuesetc.org or in Wednesday's podcast feed. You can vote in advance via email talkback at issuesetc.org, Twitter at issuesetc, or at our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc, or live Friday afternoon from 4:30 to 5 Central by calling 1-877-623-MYIE. Listeners with the best votes will win the LPR bundle package, Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. We're talking about secularized medicine and human equality. Dr. Charles Camosi of Fordham University is our guest. Dr. Camosi, many have observed that Western healthcare owes its existence to religious ideas. How is that?
Well, in a boring way, I guess, it's almost every idea in the West is somehow related to religious ideas, just because, again, up until the last 50 years or so, the idea that there would be a strong disconnect between religious tradition and the broader tradition in the West was just not heard of, really. So in that sense, it's just true of almost all our ideas. But it's particularly true, I'd argue, in healthcare, because the way healthcare developed in the West came specifically out of the early church's attempt to live out Christ's command to love one another as I have loved you. And Christ's love was very much connected to a focus on the sick, right? A focus on healing. In fact, this is why, at least in the Catholic lectionary over the last several readings of the gospel, there's been these stories about all the crowds who would follow Jesus and just basically like tire him out, and he'd have to move to a deserted place because he was constantly on the move with thousands of people. Well, the reason why they were following him is because of his capacity to heal. They were desperate to heal, to be healed, or their family members were, or friends were. And the early church took that extremely seriously. And so did the church in the Middle Ages and in the early modern and modern period. In fact, there's still lots, I don't need to tell you or your listeners, that there's still a lot of healthcare around today in the West, even a more secularized West and a secularized healthcare system that bears the name of religious groups, right? And religious icons and religious ideas. You know, I live and teach in New York City. Maybe the most important hospital in New York City is New York Presbyterian, Columbia Presbyterian. I think one out of every seven people who go to a hospital in the United States visits a hospital that's affiliated with the Catholic Church. So it's very much still a part of who we are today and what we are today. But again, you know, it's not really clear what the name Presbyterian and New York Presbyterian is actually doing anymore, or it's not exactly clear in many cases what the term Catholic in a Catholic hospital means anymore, because the delivery and structures and institutions of healthcare have become so, in many, most cases, somewhere between many and most cases, hyper-secularized. So the very idea of at least how we developed healthcare in the West from our earliest times, or at least, again, two millennia ago, come directly out of a kind of religious lens.
How has medical ethics become hostile to religious ideas?
Boy, you ask good questions and important questions, difficult questions. And my book takes about a whole chapter to try to answer that question. You could easily teach a whole course even on that question alone. And in my bioethics classes, both undergraduate and graduate, we dive into that question. I guess one way of narrating an answer to that question would be to focus on a broader disconnect between faith and science more broadly, or faith and reason more broadly, that really didn't exist again for most of the last two millennia, but especially with the Enlightenment. But not only, there's been this kind of disconnect between faith and religion on the one hand, and, you know, science and reason and biology and medicine on the other. You know, and I'm not exactly sure what accounts for that. Maybe it's, you know, the debates over evolution, or maybe you could take it all the way back to Galileo or something like that. I think both of those are way more complicated than our traditional narratives really allow us to really articulate. But yeah, so I guess that's probably part of it, the bifurcation between those two fields that were never bifurcated again, you know, before 50 years ago or so. And then I think, and I argue for this in the book, as the debates over medicine and medical ethics really became hot, certain kinds of religious ideas just simply weren't welcome in those debates by lots of people who held power in Western healthcare and medicine. And as a result, I think in part to kind of marginalize the points of view that were not welcomed by those that held power, they were dismissed as religious and therefore not part of, you know, serious debate or discussion about, you know, the hard sciences and medicine. Even today, I, as a theologian who's also a bioethicist, there are certain people who will just not like what I have to say and dismiss me on the basis of, well, aren't you just trying to like impose your religion on people? Like, aren't you a theologian? Don't you come from this other discourse over there that needs to kind of stay in its lane and kind of mind its own business when it comes to this area of discourse in life and these institutions? So I think on the one hand, it does have something to do with how the ideas developed. But I think maybe even more importantly, especially today, it's related to a kind of power play to keep certain points of view safe over there, not really participating in the discussion.
Is the new medical ethics neutral on the issue of human equality?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, it's even tough to understand what neutrality would even mean, because as with all social justice discourses, we know that neutrality favors the oppressor. So it's not, there's really no way to be neutral, period, I would argue, speaking as an ethicist and moral theologian. Even to choose not to decide is to make a choice. But that's probably not what your question is most interested in getting at. It's like, well, how is it not neutral? And in part, I think one thing that's important to highlight is what happens when you default to neutrality. You let oppressive forces flourish. So if it's, again, productivity, I love to talk about that with my students because they kind of implicitly get how our economic structures favor those who are productive over those who are a burden, right, quote unquote. And so if you're just neutral and you just kind of let the forces play themselves out, it doesn't take too long to figure out that those who are productive, who you know, produce net capital versus those who drain net capital, are going to have a better way of it and have more power and have more opportunity to speak up for themselves and those who are like them in their level of productivity, while those who are dependent on others, those who are a net burden on others, those who require the capital of others for their own flourishing are going to be in a less advantageous position, maybe in a very disadvantageous position. So no, it's impossible to be neutral at all, but it's especially impossible to be neutral when, you know, so-called neutrality is a default to these kinds of forces, for sure.
We're talking with Dr. Charles Camosi, Associate Professor of Theological and Social Ethics at Fordham University. He's author of the new book, Losing Our Dignity, How Secularized Medicine is Undermining Fundamental Human Equality. When we come back, there has been a debate at the beginning of this shift over a living and a dead human being. Why is that debate so important? No, do the wind, the sun, or the rain. Take my hand.
Where Christianity meets culture, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Are you looking for Christ-focused posters to adorn your walls? Ad Crucem has some suggestions. Come see our liturgical calendar, the Lord's Prayer, Martin Luther's morning and evening prayers, the three ecumenical creeds, and our sacristy prayer. We also have an appropriate woodcut of Luther attending to plague victims in Wittenberg and another of him administering the sacraments. Stock up for the new school year. Visit adcrucem.com. That's adcrucem.com.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're talking about secularized medicine and human equality. Dr. Carl Camosi, Associate Professor of Theological and Social Ethics at Fordham University, is our guest. Dr. Camosi, what has been the debate over living and dead human beings in medical ethics, and why is that debate so important?
Yeah, it may seem like a in the weeds issue, but it really does get to so much of what the debate is about human equality, especially in a medical context. So again, about 50 years ago, there was the dramatic shift, very dramatic shift, where we went away from fundamental human equality to something else, where we weren't exactly sure where we were going, but it actually started with the debate over brain death. So about, again, 50 years ago, we had just started doing organ transplants, and at the same time, we had just started putting people on ventilators. So in some ways, this is a problem that comes from our technology and technological development. Understandably, there was a desire to save as many lives as we could. I'm an organ donor. I support organ donations, but we didn't have a lot of organ donors at the time. We did have a lot of people with catastrophic brain injuries, which some people called brain death, on ventilators, who otherwise would have died but have been, you know, kept alive because we can now help them breathe with this new technology. And so what something called the Harvard Brain Death Commission did, I believe it was in 1968 or so, they said, well, you know, we really need these organs from these folks who are on these ventilators. They don't really have a meaningful life to speak of, but we don't want to give up something called the dead donor rule, which is that in order to donate organs, you have to be dead or donor has to be dead. And so what that committee did is it redefined death to mean not just a kind of cardiopulmonary definition of death where your heart stops beating, you stop breathing. But if you've got such a catastrophic brain injury that we can call your brain dead, you're also dead there. Even if you're pregnant and can gestate children, which brain dead people do, even if you reach puberty like brain dead people do, even if you can fight off infections and maintain homeostasis, and if you have bodily trauma, your body reacts by releasing hormones and increased heart rate, and just as any other body would in response to trauma, we said you were dead, even though your body was alive, very much alive, in fact. And so we call these individuals dead, even though they were living members of the species Homo sapiens. We weren't exactly sure, again, what the criteria was for saying that they were alive or dead. We didn't say things like, well, they're not autonomous, rational, self-aware, productive. But we knew that they weren't. That's what at least this very influential committee ended up being extremely influential. It's now the law in all 50 states was saying it's we don't know quite what makes you valuable, but it's not being a human being, a living human being that matters. And so when we define death differently there, that was what the philosopher Peter Singer said was a Copernican revolution in our ethics and law. We shifted away from the human being as the center of, you know, ethical concern, and instead to the kinds of creatures like those who are rational, self-aware, productive, autonomous, to be in the center of our moral universe. So it's something that seems like it get into the weeds, you know, like of the academic weeds of, you know, what's the difference between life and death, or how we define death, really has had extraordinary on the ground, real life impacts in almost every, you know, almost every, well, many, many different important areas of medicine.
One of those impacts was the latter years of Terry Schiavo. Tell us her story and how she met her end, in essence, at the hands of medical ethics.
Yeah, she did. So Terry was a young woman battling an eating disorder and very religious woman, Catholic woman. And she had a massive catastrophic brain injury related to her eating disorder. I think this was in 1990. In 2005, after a massive, massive set of battles, very public battles, some of your listeners may be old enough to remember, I sure am, especially in the early 2000s, where this kind of gripped the country. It was all over the news, and our politics was very much connected to these debates. I think it's very telling, maybe as a way of telling her story, what her husband, who wanted her feeding tube removed, said on her gravestone. He was allowed to make the decision to have her feeding tube removed, and then he decided it was on her gravestone. And her gravestone says something, I don't have the words exactly ready to hand, but it's something like 1990 departed this earth, 2005 at peace. I haven't started doing talks for this book yet, but it just came out. But when I do start my talks, I think I might lead with that photo as a start to the whole book, because I think that it really gets at the heart of what the book is trying to highlight as deeply problematic about our vision of fundamental human equality. Well, what does it mean? And now, those who, you know, Terry Schiavo was said to be in a vegetative state, quote unquote. Now, I don't think any living human being is a vegetable, but when you lose the concept of nature, like you talked about earlier, then it's easy to understand why somebody might call them a vegetable, right? Because they don't seem to have, again, seem to have is pretty important in light of what I'm about to say in a minute or two, seem to have, you know, the kinds of traits that are different from vegetables. Although sleep-wake cycles, which Terry had, is a little different. But anyway, so what does it mean to say that Terry departed this earth, in her husband's view, in 1990, but had sleep and wake cycles, did not require a ventilator, was breathing on her own, reacted seemingly to different sound and light? You know, this is not brain death. This is another kind of catastrophic brain injury. But this person was very much a living human being in almost everyone's estimation. But her husband wrote on her own gravestone that she departed this earth. That seems to take it up a notch in terms of how we were distinguishing between a living human being and a person. Her person, whatever that means, departed this earth, even though she was still there, and then she was at peace in 2005. We now know, and this is very key for the kind of thing that makes, hopefully, my book add something to this conversation, that you can actually do therapeutic interventions, at least early on, in cases where this kind of catastrophic brain injury takes place, and actually coax people back to a kind of consciousness. We kind of already knew that people were conscious. This goes back at least, I think, 10 years. We were able to do, sorry, this is a long answer, but this is important. We were able to do brain scans of people in a so-called vegetative state, and we realized that 30% of them could actually respond to yes or no questions. So they would actually do studies where they would ask people in a so-called vegetative state to imagine that they were playing tennis if the answer was yes, or reading in their room if the answer was no. And they would ask them yes or no questions that only they would know the answer to, and they would get it right. They could read the, you know, part of the brain that was lighting up in the motor part of the brain or the other part of the brain. And so we know that at the very least, this was a totally imprecise, you know, vegetative state, totally imprecise diagnosis. But now we now know, on top of that, that if you do the right therapeutic interventions, you can actually coax people who have no indication that they're rational or self-aware to being rational or self-aware again. And so when we say, again, this gets back to the, you know, nature versus accident. Does it really matter that Terry Schiavo wasn't expressing rationality and self-awareness? If we now know that if she had gotten interventions early on that it could have come back, was she only valuable because we could get it back? Or is she valuable simply because she shares the same nature as the rest of us and these other things are accidental to her true worth and dignity?
How would an ethic grounded in intrinsic human equality, how would it regard Terri Schiavo?
Well, because Terri Schiavo is like us in the only way that matters, which is she shares a common human nature with us, she would be regarded as our equal. Now, that's not to say that there wouldn't eventually come a time where you might say that certain kinds of extraordinary treatments can be illicitly withdrawn. We say that about lots of individuals, including people who are totally wide awake and say, I don't want to be on a ventilator anymore. And the key thing for me in the book is emphasizing fundamental human equality, you know, metaphysical human equality, the very thing which makes us of our very natures equal, in the fundamental part of who we are equal. That's what I'm focusing in on Terri Schiavo. When you say that even though her body, her living human body, again, which has sleep-wake cycles for crying out loud, is there, but she has departed, right? 1990, she departed. That's the fundamental mistake I think we need to highlight. But it's a fundamental mistake that unfortunately exists through a lot of our most important debates about issues of medical ethics right now.
Dr. Charles Camosi is our guest, associate professor of theological and social ethics at Fordham University and author of the new book, Losing Our Dignity, How Secularized Medicine is Undermining Fundamental Human Equality. We'll talk about Roe v. Wade and the role it played in the advancement of secular medical ethics next. Thanks to our beloved on-demand listeners, Issues Etc. continues to rank among the top podcasts in religion and spirituality. You can help us climb the charts by subscribing, rating, and reviewing Issues Etc. Type Issues Etc. in your podcast provider, hit the subscription button, and leave us a 5-star review. This will make it easier for other podcast listeners to find Issues Etc. Help us cast ChristNet on the internet. Subscribe, rate, and review Issues Etc. today.
Not everyone is comfortable with new technology. Dial-A Podcast gives all generations of your congregation an easy way to hear your sermons, or even devotionals and Bible studies. Once you've completed a simple one-time setup, we take care of the rest. All your congregants have to do is dial the number from any phone to listen to your latest podcast, all at no additional cost to them. Dial-A Podcast. Extend the reach of your sermons. Get started at dialapodcast.com now.
Your comprehensive source for information, teaching, and truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Is your school or homeschool ready to take the next step in teaching students with learning challenges? We can help. The Simply Classical curriculum, voted number one for special learners, is available from Memoria Press for students with autism, learning disabilities, or Down syndrome. We provide everything you need for a full year. Use promo code LPR21 at simplyclassical.com. Simplyclassical.com.
For your next family vacation, consider Our Beach House, a charming 3-bedroom vacation rental on beautiful Siesta Key. Just off Sarasota, Florida, Siesta Key Beach, consistently voted America's best, is just 100 steps away. Whether you're watching the sunset over the Gulf of Mexico or frolicking in the warm surf, you and your family will fall in love with Siesta Key. Check us out at SiestaKeyRentalGenie.com or call Virginia at 941-266-1858.
Talking about secularized medicine and human equality, Dr. Charles Camosi is our guest of Fordham University. Dr. Camosi, what role did Roe v. Wade play in the advancement of secular medical ethics?
A huge one, I think, especially getting back to a question I answered earlier about how, you know, a secular medical ethics, you know, advanced more broadly. I think the debate I know as a student of this, the abortion debate itself really accelerated the marginalization of religious views from debate over these topics. in part because, though there are exceptions, right, there's a group called Catholics for Choice, and there are lots and lots of pro-choice Christians. But in the main, the loudest pro-life voices were, in fact, religious voices. And it was important for those that held power to keep those voices marginalized and have their arguments not heard, not really heard, but to simply dismiss them as, again, are you just imposing your religion onto me? You know, we have religious freedom in this country. All the chestnuts that we've heard over, you know, since Roe versus Wade. And I think we're about to find a similar kind of thing done, you know, if there is a result that's in favor of prenatal justice in the Dobbs decision coming up next with the Supreme Court decision next summer, it's the challenge to a 15-week abortion ban in Mississippi is before the court. First one before viability that the court has really been interested in hearing, actually, since Roe versus Wade. Then I think we're going to hear a lot of the same kinds of discussions, like stop imposing your religion. This is right-wing religion stuff. But in reality, there, again, getting back to the lack of neutral space, there is no neutral space on this issue. You can't, the secular folks who engage on these questions, whether they're pro-life or pro-choice, bring their own values to bear, bring their own foundational principles to bear, their own first principles to bear that others don't share. So why should it be, this is a big focus in the book, actually, in the first part of the book, is why should it be that those who have religious first principles, explicitly religious first principles, be in a different place than those who have secular first principles, right? So if my view of fundamental equality comes from the fact that we share a nature which bears the image and likeness of God, and someone else says my view of human equality comes from the fact that we are autonomous human beings, we're both bringing those first principles to bear in those discussions. And there's really no way, no fair way anyway, to exclude me from those discussions because I'm religious and include the other because they're secular. And except the temptation to exclude from those who hold power is profound. So it may not be a principled distinction, but it's a distinction that keeps lots and lots of views that people don't want to be faced with out of these discussions. And Roe versus Wade played a huge role in advancing that kind of strategy, frankly.
Why must intrinsic human equality and dignity extend to the unborn from conception forward?
And again, this is getting back to the lack of distinction between, you know, a religious approach and a scientific one that I mentioned earlier. If we think that all human beings matter the same, again, regardless of your actualized traits, regardless of in what level of sophistication or power those traits exist in you, but really just you are the same kind of creature as me, and therefore that's why we're equal. That applies in the disability rights debates. It applies at the end of life debates. It also applies the beginning of life debates. You know, when is there a creature like me in coming into existence? You know, you can make up a story about how it's only when there's a brain or only when there's a heartbeat, but that's just not scientifically accurate. The same kind of creature that I am comes to existence when there is an organism, a fellow member of the species Homo sapiens. And so it's a very biologically based principle. It draws on a metaphysical claim, right? But and we could reject the metaphysical claim, but then this has a cascading effect on all these other issues we've been talking about. But if we accept the claim that what makes us, what makes us equal is that we share a nature, a human nature, a Homo sapiens nature, then it's really a question of biology to determine when that nature comes to existence. And every, you know, embryology textbook I'm aware of notes that this happens after fertilization.
How has secular medical ethics threatened people with neurodegenerative diseases?
Well, I think it's an offshoot of the kind of Roe versus Wade discussion. So I get into, I mean, in a certain way, you could call, well, catastrophic brain injuries are a little bit different than neurodegenerative diseases, but your listeners may be familiar with the debates in the last few years over British toddlers like Alfie Evans and Charlie Gard. They had neurodegenerative diseases, and especially in the case of Alfie Evans, we weren't exactly even sure what it was, why he had such a dramatic decline and lost his, I'll just say the four again, rationality, self-awareness, autonomy, and productivity. But when those who had a different, and again, in the UK, it's maybe a little bit more advanced than it is in the here in the US, but in terms of, you know, how far that we've moved along these lines, when religious voices, including Alfie Evans's parents, who were very religious, and with their legal team they hired were very religious, came forward and said, hey, listen, if you're going to take a little boy off of life support who is otherwise healthy despite his neurodegenerative disease because you think it's better for him to die, you're aiming at his death, and that's a kind of euthanasia. At least in the tradition I come from, it doesn't really matter whether you're actively killing or if you're, you know, refusing to aid. It's the same kind of act if what you aim at is death. This happens all the time, frankly, in medical ethics. Because this is pretty well advanced. I'm perfectly fine, and the tradition is perfectly fine with removing burdensome treatment. The tradition is not fine with saying it's time to stop helping you breathe now. It's time to help stopping you eat now because we've decided that your life is no longer worth living. From my perspective and from the tradition's perspective, that's no different than giving them an overdose of pain medication. In fact, it might be worse because they could feel pain in a way that you wouldn't if you gave them an overdose of pain medication or something like that. But I guess the responses that I highlight in the book to someone like Alfie Evans and the arguments that his lawyers and his family was making was just so hostile, like unbelievably hostile. And I think that gets into the central point I was making earlier about how this is really, there's no really principle distinction to be hostile, right? There's no reason to discriminate against those with religious ideas here. All ideas, all first principles should be welcome in a liberal society. But the kind of hostility that was directed at these folks for making this claim was unbelievable. Unbelievable. The kind of rage and wrath that came through in the language, even from the judge himself, who called out Alfie Evans's parents' lawyers and counsel for hurting their case by making the kinds of arguments that I've been discussing over the last, whatever, how long we've been on or so, 30 minutes maybe, to the point where it seemed clear that the judge himself was really so angry that this was going to hurt Alfie Evans' case because he was so put off by these kinds of arguments. But you can see how this, the through line through all of this works. Once you start with brain death and you say, well, you know, there's a difference between a living human being and a person, and brain dead people are maybe living human beings, but they're not persons. Same with prenatal children, same with those who are quote vegetative. You can understand how, you know, a pink, plump, otherwise healthy little boy named Alfie Evans would also be judged as a human non-person, and how threatened, frankly, a lot of secular medical ethics and, frankly, secular law, which has been built on this fundamental mistake, would be by a religious set of arguments that really challenges it.
Who else is threatened in the future by the cultural rejection of human equality?
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine a listener hearing what's been said so far and trying to put me into a box and say, well, this is, you know, a right-wing pro-lifer. And I hope your listeners don't put me in that box, because I don't think at all that this is what I know. This is not what I'm arguing at all. In fact, I've done my best to try to have a consistent ethic of life in my work and to apply the principles consistently wherever they go. And here is where this is going. And this is how I finish my book. It's going to people, and I've already mentioned this, but it's good to underline here. It's going to people who are at the end of their lives with later stage dementia. So if we just follow, again, the through line of this point of view clearly and consistently to its logical conclusions, your grandmother or mother who isn't aware of her own name, who is struggling, who thinks it's 1955, who is not able to go to the bathroom herself, who is not able to be independent and autonomous and productive, that person is not going to matter the same as everyone else. And in fact, you could make the argument that we've already kind of gone there. We, in many cases, not all, some people in these circumstances are treated with the dignity proper to their fundamental equality with the rest of us. But in many cases, let's just be honest, in the pandemic, help focus attention on this in a helpful way, I think. We kind of warehouse these people away from the rest of the culture, right? We kind of, you know, put them even in a kind of warehouse, as it were, where they're desperately lonely. They're not, you know, they don't have interactions with others. They're often not kept clean. And given enough to do to lead a kind of flourishing human life, given their capacities, and just kind of wait for them to die. In fact, many of your listeners may have interacted with immigrants to this country who become aware that this is what we do with this population and are just stunned that this is how we treat our elderly, and especially our elderly with later stage dementia. But again, if we just follow the through line here, there's really no reason to say that this obviously living human being who has lost their rationality, self-awareness, autonomy, and productivity matters the same as the rest of us. They don't, on this view, this mistaken view, they don't matter the same as the rest of us. And this population is set to double. The population of later stage, of those with later stage dementia, is set to double over the next generation. And we already don't have the resources in place to really care for this group of people like they ought to be cared for, that is, as our equals. What's going to happen? What is going to happen when this population doubles and we have a decision to make about whether we're going to put resources into this population or not? I really fear that we're going to slouch towards one of two things, or maybe both, that we're going to develop robots essentially to take care of this population in some ways. And I get into this in the book. We've already started that. And then I hope this doesn't sound too dramatic, but I think we're going to just use assisted suicide and euthanasia in an active way. You know, you can do it the other way with removing somebody's ventilator or removing their feeding tube. But with this population, you can't really do that. I mean, you can kind of let them waste away in nursing homes like we do now, but I wonder if we'll just get to the point where we just say it's better that they just die right now than we keep them in this kind of warehouse of death. And either one is just a disaster, a moral disaster, but it's a specific kind of moral disaster. It's a disaster that comes from applying consistently the kinds of views and the kinds of arguments, the vision, frankly, that I've been outlining in the book and that we've been talking about so far.
Dr. Charles Camosi is our guest, author of the new book, Losing Our Dignity, How Secularized Medicine is Undermining Fundamental Human Equality. How has a Christian ethic regarded those with cognitive dysfunction or malfunction? We'll answer that question next.
The church's music from the 20th century. The 17th century. The 11th century. Century. The 4th century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Solid, serious, substantive. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Every pastor knows this phrase. It goes something like this: Pastor, I have a question. In fact, every church worker is familiar with this phrase because the church workers of the LCMS, pastors, teachers, deaconesses, frequently answer questions that are put to them by the people they serve. In the August issue of the Lutheran Witness, the pastors, teachers, and deaconesses of the LCMS answer the questions they are most commonly asked. To get your copy, visit cph.org/witness and visit our website, witness.lcms.org, to learn more. The Lutheran Witness, helping you look at the world from a Lutheran perspective.
Do you know any military veterans in your church or community? Do you have a passion to support and reach them with the gospel of Jesus Christ? Then Operation Barnabas is for you. Called by Christ's love, Operation Barnabas engages, empowers, and equips LCMS faith communities to provide hope, healing, and support to military-connected persons living in their community. Operation Barnabas is a program of LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. Find out more at lcms.org/armedforces.
Dr. Charles Camosi is our guest as we're discussing secularized medicine and human equality. He's associate professor of theological and social ethics at Fordham University. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Dr. Camosi, how has a Christian ethic regarded those with cognitive dysfunction or malfunction?
Well, again, anybody who's historically aware knows that Christians haven't always lived this out consistently. But at least our vision is one where, again, if we continue with the vision of a human nature, which makes us all equal, then these folks obviously have a common human nature, one that that's shared with us. It's not being expressed to its fullness, of course. It's unlikely to be, given the therapeutic interventions available. But throughout Christian history, there's kind of been a focus in a way with a kind of respect for these populations that, again, once you've rejected the theological underpinnings of that respect, is tough to understand, but was definitely there. I conclude my book actually with a quote from scripture from the book of Sirach, where the author is calling the reader of Sirach to say, show the same respect to your father, even though his mind fail. He uses that language, even though his mind fail. So that's almost as explicit as you can get with regard to that, right? Like, even if his mind fail, you are to treat him as who he is. He's still your father. There's, at least in my world of academic bioethics, one of the more famous articles is written by Stanley Hauerwas, a famous Protestant theologian. And the title of one of his articles in this regard was, "My Uncle Charlie isn't much of a person, but he's still my Uncle Charlie." What he was trying to provocatively get at in that title was something we've been talking about again for this whole episode, is who we are at our most fundamental parts of who we are, what makes us us, and what makes us us in relationship to others in the context of a family, has nothing to do with the kinds of traits that we say persons have, but rather, you know, the kinds of relationships that we are in our essence. And so the Book of Sirach, the views of someone like Stanley Hauerwas and many others say your father, your uncle, your mother, your grandmother, they don't cease to be those people for you simply because they lose these accidental traits. They nevertheless remain not only the fundamental human being they are, but the kind of human being who exists in a particular kind of relationship to you. That relationship does not go away. And sacred scripture insists that we keep that relationship in the same sacred place it was before those with cognitive dysfunctions or malfunctions came about.
Can we begin a dialogue with those who are uncomfortable with the kind of religious ideas that have, up until the last century, undergirded medical ethics?
That's a really, really important question. We can certainly begin one. You know, I have kind of like a three-phase approach for what I'm calling the dementia kind of emergency or cultural emergency here over the next 20 years. One is to just kind of like focus on our own life and our own decisions to make space for people who lack personhood in a way that the broader culture would understand it, but nevertheless count the same as you or me. The second phase is and that's something we could all do immediately, actually, or most of us can do, many of us can do immediately. Or at least we can make plans to do it. If we can't do it immediately, it's up to us whether we choose to do that or not. The second part is not up to us. It's partially up to us in the sense we absolutely have to begin a dialogue. We have to try. The stakes are way, way too high to do anything else. We have to try to make the surrounding culture, though it be hostile, see what is happening here. And I have some hope about this, actually, because unlike several of the other issues that I mentioned earlier in our discussion, the issue of dementia and late stage dementia has not been politicized the way that brain death and vegetative state and abortion and even Alfie Evans and Charlie Gard neurodegenerative disease in toddlers has. At least it hasn't yet been politicized. So I don't need to tell you, in our hyper political, hyper polarized culture where everything seems to flow through the lens of left right dichotomous, attacking, venomous relationships, here's an issue, you know, end of life dementia, which doesn't seem to fit neatly into that. And so I wonder if that's a really important tool for the dialogue, to start there and say, well, what about your grandmother who is no longer rational or self-aware, autonomous and productive? Does she matter the same as you and I? If the individual that we're trying to dialogue with says yes, maybe that's a starting point for kind of building out then and saying, well, if that's true, right, what else might follow from that? And also, frankly, what else should we do? Even if we don't want to go to the other issues right away, we could say, well, let's focus on that. What can we do about what's going to happen over the next two decades? And in fact, what's happening right now? Can we work together, even though we disagree on these other issues, to build institutions, to build resources, to treat this population as fundamentally equal to us? But I mean, that may sound like ivory tower, disconnected professor who's got rose tinted glasses or something. But my experience, frankly, both in my public interactions and interactions with my students, is that that is a good place to start. That is a place where we can actually maybe not be totally impacted by our toxic political culture and just focus on where we could find common ground.
How do we recapture this view of human equality that's grounded in God as creator? And since we are contingent beings bearing his image, we will treat one another no matter what the other circumstances, because they do have equal dignity and value as ourselves.
This is a big debate, certainly among theologians. I just got a email recently from a former student who read my book and said, you know, I'm not exactly sure that your call to, you know, treat populations ethically is actually enough or even the place to start. He thought that you really need to start with the hearts of people and help people have a broader relationship with that creator, a grace-filled relationship with that creator that can change the human heart in a way so that human heart can see differently. And I take that point, and that's certainly one way to do it. But I think it also works the other way. I think it also works that the surrounding hostile culture of the early church were taken with the fact that the line is, see how these Christians love one another. And that was an evangelical tool as well, and was able to really help convert a number of people to the faith and to see they wanted to be a part of that loving community, and that helped them to see and to see in a different way as well. And I mentioned this in the book. There's some historical evidence to show that the early church went from this persecuted kind of weird sect that was on the margins of the culture to being a somewhat dominant force, in part because of how Christians reacted to plagues and other kind of medical emergencies. There are some very good historians who argue that. And so I just wonder if there's a way that we can witness, Christians can witness to this human equality grounded in God as creator, especially maybe with the issue of the coming emergency on dementia, with dementia. Could the surrounding hostile culture once again look around and say, see how these Christians love one another, and be brought into that kind of way of seeing? And having, frankly, in a desperately lonely culture, especially post-pandemic, people just desperately wanting to live in a life of community, of loving community, especially if they are in a vulnerable context. Could that be so attractive that, again, once again, the church could bring in a disaffected, even hostile group into its ranks and to help them see with the love of Christ? I don't know, but I know what's happened in the past. And let me just say this, the reason to help other people is because they need help, but it could also maybe have this other impact that it could help the culture recapture a view of human equality, frankly.
Dr. Charles Camosi is Associate Professor of Theological and Social Ethics at Fordham University. He's author of the new book, Losing Our Dignity, How Secularized Medicine is Undermining Fundamental Human Equality. You can purchase this book at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Talk On Demand Archives. Dr. Camosi, thank you again.
My pleasure.
We will review the movie The Green Knight with Pastor Ted Geese right after this. If you were unable to attend this year's Making the Case conference, we have good news for you. We've produced a recording of each of the speakers' presentations, all of the worship services, and the hymn sing. You can watch an on-demand video stream for a tax-deductible contribution of $300 to Issues Etc. by Labor Day. Learn more at issuesetc.org or make your $300 check payable to Issues Etc. and send it to Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
We love our on-demand listeners. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The world is filled with darkness now. It's maybe darker than it's ever been before.
Issues Etc. guest Dr. Adam Kuntz.
The reason to come to Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne and to study to be a pastor is so that the light of Christ can shine that much more brightly. It's not a time for retreat. It's not a time for hiding. It's a time to hear the Lord's call and to come out and to serve Him, to shine His light into very dark places in people's souls, in people's lives, throughout our nation and throughout the world.
Learn more about studying for the vocation of pastor at ctsfw.edu or call 1-800-481-2155. Forming servants in Jesus Christ who teach the faithful, reach the lost, and care for all. Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. ctsfw.edu or 1-800-481-2155.
Faith Lutheran School in Plano, Texas is now enrolling for the coming school year. What makes us unique? A confessional Lutheran school offering a classical education for preschool through the 12th grades. Faith Lutheran School features rigorous classes that incorporate a focus on wisdom, truth, virtue, and the historic Christian faith. Live online classes are also available for high school students worldwide. To learn more about Faith Lutheran School or to submit an application, visit flsplano.org. That's flsplano.org.